Merry Easter, you glorious chicks, bunnies, lambs, and other bouncing springtime fauna. I hope that the Easter Bunny has laid a delicious array of chocolate eggs for each and every one of you, and that any parents or guardians of small children have managed to navigate the choppy waters of the post-Easter egg sugar crash with calm, patience, and their sanity still intact. Safe to say, I have had three sugar crashes today myself, never mind going into my children, and it has been quite the roller coaster of emotions. This, once again, is going to be a short and sweet introduction, because there's not much news at Worst Foot Forward headquarters. Safe to say, we are about to embark on another large tranche of recordings over the next few weeks, talking to a delightful collection of performers, writers, and others as we seek to flesh out our ever-expanding encyclopedia of heroic failure. We thank you as ever for your support, both in the form of star ratings on podcatchers and in the form of pounds, dollars, euros, and thankfully no Bitcoin on patreon.com. And indeed, for the many of you out there who do neither, but just listen to us every week and enjoy the business that we put into your ears. It's really cracking that you all keep listening and supporting us. You keep listening, you keep telling your friends, lovers, dogs, pets, work colleagues, and anyone you find yourself on a Zoom call with about the show. We'll keep making them. We've got some really good fun ones lined up with a variety of humans whose company and facts we think you will enjoy. So please sit tight for those. As ever, we're going to ask you to like and subscribe. I mean, the things that you can like, we've got a Facebook page. We've only got a couple of people who communicate with us via that, as it is a bit of a dusty vault in a long-forgotten museum. The best place to contact us is on our Twitter page, at Worst Foot, which is a delightful little forum of oddities and trivia. And if you want to help us, the best thing you can do is leave reviews. We sort of potter along at the speed of a couple of reviews a month, and that's lovely, and that sort of keeps the iTunes algorithm vaguely interested in us. But I'm well aware that tomorrow is a bank holiday, and a large swathe of this very silly little planet will be doing bugger all other than eating chocolate tomorrow. So if you want to give your thumb a little bit of exercise and just pop a 5-star review for us, that'd be extraordinarily welcome. As you can hear, I'm entering what is clearly my fourth sugar crash of the day. So before I turn into a mumbling heap of half-formed syllables, I'm going to get out of my own way and prepare you for an episode that could well be an all-time great. I'm saying this with, frankly, an enormous amount of hubris, but on point for this. But one of my favourite guests, a topic that I'm sure the moment you saw it pop up in your podcast, you thought, oh, why is it taking them 200 episodes to get to this one? And a wonderful variety of stories and idiots and mishaps. So enjoy listening about the world's worst explorers. I hope you enjoy it as much as we enjoyed recording it. See you next week. Ta-ta!
Hello and welcome to Worst Foot Forward, where we celebrate the best of the worst. I'm Barry McStay, and each week I, my co-host and our guest, propose our candidates for the title of the world's worst something. And this week, we are taking one small step for man, mainly because both Ben and I are below average height, and we're going in search of the world's worst explorer. To that end, we're just going outside now, and we may be some time, probably about an hour-ish, give or take. Why do we climb this mountain? Because it's there. And because, if you're not hosting a podcast in 2021, do you even truly exist? And alongside me is the Sherpa to my Hillary. It's Dr. Livingston, I presume. Oh, no, wait. It's Ben Vandeveld.
Hello, Mr. McStay. I, in having read about this, have discovered some of the most remarkable human beings. And as the more explorations I've read about, the more I think that if I were to try and search for the source of the Thames I'd be dead in 30 minutes.
I've got quite a good sense of direction, but I don't know if that applies to places I haven't been already. I can have been in one place once, like 10 years ago, mm-hmm. and know my way around it again when I go back. So I don't know if that's exploration or whether that's repetition.
My internal compass is surrounded by magnets. I might have talked about this on the show before. I know I've got a bad sense of direction, so I try and second guess it. And in second guessing it, I get it even more wrong.
Oh, nice. Good. The other thing I was thinking about exploration is it's quite like tribal and nationalistic in lots of ways, because I know, being Irish, and as I think our guests will probably agree, who discovered America? It's obviously St. Brendan who went to America on a curragh. It's not Christopher Columbus, and it's not the Chinese, and it's not the Vikings. So I'd be interested to see if we sort of come to different conclusions about who were the firsts along the way when we get into
and
it.
And indeed, being Jewish, what are the Jews most famous for? Getting lost in the desert for 40 years. Like, Moses may have been many things, but a strong navigator was not one of them.
To be fair to him, though, he did invent the first bypass when he bypassed the Red Sea.
Very good.
Can't find the way around. We just go straight through it.
Yeah, but didn't get the planning permission. But did it anyway. Yeah. When you're God, you don't need to get planning permission.
No. Very shoddy, though. It fell down very soon after.
Let us introduce this week's guest who is joining us on our trail up mountains and down dales. He is one of the finest stand-ups to come out of Ireland, and considering the super heavyweight company that puts him in, that's some praise. He's a regular panellist on BBC Radio 4's News Quiz, BBC Ulster's Blame Game, and BBC Radio Scotland's Breaking the News. We're sure once BBC Cymru comes up with a satirical panel show, he'll be first on the team sheet. As well as his work on radio and TV, and appearing live all over the world, from Melbourne to Montreal, he is also an award-winning documentary maker for RTE, broadcasting show about St. Patrick and the Vikings. That is, I should point out, two separate series, not an incredible time-travelling mashup. Quick summary.
That is a sitcom I would totally watch.
Well, either that or it's a soul group from Dublin. Quick summary of the pair of them. St. Patrick, not as good at pest control as legend would have us believe, and the Vikings, actually pretty good farmers and artisans rather than pirates with anger management issues and a magic mushroom addiction. With his arcane historical trivial senses already finely honed, it's a delight to peer through the thick jungle foliage and welcome Mr. Neil Delamere. Hello, Neil.
Hello. Hello, my friends. I have to say, Barry, I really, really enjoyed what you just said, that you've a very good sense of direction if you've been there already. Yeah. I don't know how useful that would be as an explorer. Not at all useful, I think we all we're looking for the Northwest Passage. Well, I mean, I could help you out if I knew where the Northwest Passage was.
If I was able to go, I swear I've been here before.
You see, if you'd gone on the first one, you'd be good on the rescue, I think. maybe then, but yeah. And yes, St. Brendan did 100% discover America.
Oh, was it? The fella who did the Contiki also did the Brendan the Navigator recreation, and they did the journey from Ireland to Newfoundland, I think.
Yeah, I remember talking. I'm not a particularly nationalistic person. I know, as you said, exploration gets very nationalistic. But I remember doing a gig and suggesting, by the way, Ben, that's the difference between if you're from the Republic, like Barry and I are, and the Northerners, in that when we build a boat, it gets to America.
And indeed, when my people build a boat, we have to make sure that there's two of every animal on it. So,
yeah, or it floats gently down the Nile and is rescued. Yeah, and I did that joke, and I like the way you're laughing at it, but I did it in the Ulster Hall, and ho, ho. But I stuck to my ground, and I did the joke and continued behind that plexiglass.
They're the ones who built a museum to the fucking Titanic. They've got to be able to take it.
Yeah, we need a Brendan museum, don't we? But build stuff out of leather. This is the key. Leather is the key.
That is a slogan for a very different podcast.
and a very niche shop.
Clearly you're a brave man to be cracking those sort of jokes. What would you say you're less good at? What are you worst at in the world?
Yes, I've listened to this podcast, and you tend to ask people this. I mean, there's so many things that people are terrible at. I was genuinely trying to think the worst thing. I have no spatial awareness. Do you know those? You know those in an IQ test where they ask you the verbal thing, and comics tend to be good in that, maths and fine. Do you know the one where it goes, "What shape would this shape be if we move it 180 degrees?"
Yeah.
I just like, why would you move it 180 degrees? I have no idea which of the following four shapes it is. To the extent that I've always gotten it wrong. Like, even if the first shape is a circle or a square, I will still, which cannot change. Sorry, I was trying to explain that joke for Ben, who was actually in his head going, well, surely that's the same. Right? But that's how bad I am. And I found myself the other day, like, you know, people who can lift a sofa upstairs. See two fellas lifting up, or two people, you know, sofas can be lifted by everybody, upstairs, and they know which way to bend it and which way to slide it into a room. Like, all the sofas in my house are downstairs because that's where they should be. And I can't get up the stairs.
Your living room looks like a broken game of Tetris.
Yeah.
Do you know, when I have a sandwich, right, I toast two slices of bread. This is really sad, but I found myself doing this the other day, right? And I buttered both slices of toast, and then I'll have a cheeky little bite out one of the slices of toast, right? It takes me about 5 minutes to figure out where on the other slice of toast I need to bite. So the two bites overlap, to the extent that I get it wrong so often, I have to overlay the full slice of toast on the slice of toast with the bite out of it, and then bite the bite away.
If I never need to distract you, I'm just going to my toddler's toy that is the cube with the holes cut out of the basic Euclidean shape. So you just have to pop a triangle in the triangle hole and
I'll be sitting in a corner just rocking back and forth, just hitting myself in the head. Like, you know, like a distressed primate. Yeah. You know, yeah.
The first thing I found was I went to ancient Greek world and found information about a brilliant Greek sailor called Pytheas. And Pytheas has a map that is sadly lost to antiquity, but he was the...
Do you know what they need? A map to find
that
map.
They do, precisely. And he lived in what is sort of now modern-day Marseille, but he, for the ancient Greeks, was the ancient Greek who sailed the furthest from Greece and returned home. And he talked about a land called Thule. And Thule was 1 week's sailing north of Britain. And so he probably found either the Orkneys, the Shetlands, the Faroe Islands, maybe Iceland, maybe all the islands around Estonia, one of those. And when he returned home, none of the Greeks would believe him because he talked about the ocean congealing because it was so cold. Obviously, there were ice flows there. Yeah. And we know this because, well, we live quite near it and we've been on or seen footage of boats on there. But going back to ancient Greece, they thought he was absolutely nuts. He described it, the sea, as having the consistency of a jellyfish, which seems... This is a direct translation from Polybius, the historian, who is citing what Pytheas said. And I'm going to say that I think he'd been drinking a bit too much seawater by the time he came to that description. Next question. This is the sort of question that should be asked by Stephen Fry or Sandy Toksvig, and indeed probably has been. Who was the first person to circumnavigate the globe?
Now, we had a discussion about circumnavigation recently on the podcast. Mm-hmm.
So it's probably not Vasco da Gama.
Nope.
Or Ferdinand Magellan.
Nope, neither. Well, Magellan is the official holder of that title.
Except that he didn't, because it was his ship, his expedition made it back, but he didn't finish it. And he did one earlier where I think he went to, like, the Philippines and then came back and then sort of did the other bit of it from the Philippines and another journey. So he did a circumnavigation, but not all in one go.
Yeah, that's the equivalent of getting a hat trick in cricket, but over two innings. Like, you've done it technically, but it doesn't really count. But no, I mean, you're right. His crew sort of did officially, but no, there's a gentleman who is much forgotten from history because, ding, 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 they're a person of colour. And this is Enrique of Malacca. And Malacca is in Malaysia. And he was either a native Malay or he may have been from the Philippines. And he was enslaved by Magellan and taken all the way back from Malacca to Portugal. Then went on the next expedition from Portugal west out to the Americas and then came back. Ah. And there is contention amongst historians that he may have completed the last part of the journey on his own. So it's cool. A little bit muddy, but I love the fact that the first guy round the world was this chap. And Enrique, I should point out, was not his real name. His real name may well have been Pang Lima Awang. He got given a Hispanic name instead.
That's cool.
So they're good explorers, though, surely. The people you've mentioned so far, have I fundamentally misunderstood the tenor of this podcast?
No, Ben is giving us some context before he goes low.
Context.
Yes.
Sorry, I'm all about Twitter and Instagram. I just need bursts of utter outrage.
Don't worry, then. Let me tell you.
They're coming.
They're coming. The two people I want to talk about mainly are so haphazard. I just need to give you a little amuse-bouche of competence. So, let me tell you about Maurice Wilson, who is a perfect example of the sort of British eccentricity that we love on this podcast. He was a soldier, good, a mountaineer, questionable, an aviator, just, and according to his Wikipedia entry, a mystic.
Oh, God.
Now,
put down the crystal and pick up the compass.
Yeah. Exactly.
How did you finally find the rescue helicopter? I followed the sound of wind chimes.
I'd like to hope that there's someone out there who last week put mystic as their occupation on the census. Yeah. His story is it's quite tragic because the beginning of his life is remarkable. He served in World War One. He became a captain. He fought at Passchendaele and won the Military Cross for his part in an engagement where he was the only uninjured survivor of his unit.
So maybe a coward.
I mean, I'm not sure.
We can't be sure.
We can't be sure, but I'm not sure how I feel as a British person being on a podcast with two Irishmen giggling about a British coward in World War One.
50,000 Irish soldiers died in that World War fighting for Britain.
Sorry, I forgot you were part of us then. Fair enough. That's fine. We'll not.
How soon you forget?
Oh, our sacrifice has just been wiped away. Like
Arthur,
Enrique,
Griffith would be appalled. Yeah. You don't even know who he is.
Absolutely not a Scooby-Doo.
He could actually said any Irish person's name.
In
the early 1990s.
Yeah, I mean, for me, Irish history begins in 1990 with your national team reaching the World Cup under the guiding hand of Jack Charlton.
Yeah, I mean, for many of us, it also does. Yeah.
That's fair. That's utterly fair enough. If you're going to pick any era of Irish history, that's where we're
Yeah, like, sure, Charles Stuart Parnell, but who I really care about is true Irishmen like Andy Townsend and Tony Cascarino. So anyway, Maurice Wilson leaves the army in 1919 and finds post-war life pretty difficult. He travels all over the world, the States, New Zealand, holds various jobs, and he becomes quite ill. And by 1932, he's quite seriously ill, and he undergoes a secret treatment in Mayfair involving 35 days of intensive prayer and fasting. By the end of that, he decides what he needs to do is go to Mount Everest and preach his own brand of Christianity and Eastern mysticism from the peak of Mount Everest. And
of course.
And his plan to get there, and I swear this is true, his plan to do that is to crash land a small aeroplane on the upper slopes of Everest and walk the rest of the way to the summit.
That is, I mean, I don't know. I'm assuming both of you have sort of driven to remote places for a gig.
Yeah.
Sorry, I would go to the point where that's a full-on Ryanair flight plan. Yeah. Not top of the mountain, near the top of the mountain, and you make your own way to the top of the mountain. That's O'Leary written all over it.
Yeah, an extra 50 quid, you give an oxygen tank. Yeah. Did he? I mean, I presume he didn't make it because that's about 20 years before Hillary, but how far did he get?
Did he get to the top and then somebody tried to sell him a scratch card for a children's charity at the top?
I mean, he got surprisingly close. And I should point out, I've told you in the introduction that he's an aviator and a mountaineer. He was not. He he made no attempt to learn mountaineering, even basics like using an ice axe and a crampon. Instead, he spent 5 weeks on a walking holiday in the Lake District and then just declared himself ready.
This is why I think, you know, Britain is struggling so much with its loss of empire and statues and all of that at the moment, is the immense sense of self-confidence that the country dwelt in 100 years ago. Just doesn't, that being told that you can no longer do these things is really difficult.
Yes, like, I mean, some people say, why would you climb Everest? Because it's there. But in the case of Maurice Wilson, why would you climb Mount Everest? Because I'm mentally ill and suffering PTSD.
Yeah.
He, when he first tried to practice flying his plane called the Gypsy Moth. So, oh, sorry, no, the Gypsy Moth was the first plane he bought. The second plane that he flew to India was called the Everest. And as he was practicing it to fly to Tibet, he crashed it in a field near Bradford.
Yeah.
He finally managed to get take off, but everywhere he went, the British Air Ministry in all the parts of the empire, Cairo, Bahrain, Persia, kept saying, we're not giving you the permission to fly. This is absolute suicide. And he kept ignoring them and kept going. Eventually, he managed to make his way to Tibet. By 1934, he was in Darjeeling. Members of the empire were desperately trying to stop him doing this, to the extent that he had to disguise himself as a Buddhist monk to be able to get to where he wanted to start on Everest. He finally reached Everest, and you'll be unsurprised to know, he made an absolute hash of it. But his diary is wonderfully understated. In his diary he wrote, "It's the weather that's beaten me. What damned bad luck." No, mate, it's your complete failure to prepare for this.
That's the climate. That's what did he think it was going to be? A balmy 12 degrees?
Yes.
Maybe wear a coat.
Yeah. Everest was snowy.
The trip advisor reviews never mentioned it. Everest, or Chomolungma, as I think is its Tibetan name, I think there's suggestions that it would have been pronounced Everest when it was originally named. That the guy
was named after George Everest, yeah.
Yeah.
Who was...
In the same way that...
who was George Everest?
Charles Stuart Parnell, who you mentioned, would be Charles Stuart Parnell. They'd have emphasized a different part of the word. I don't know. Who's it? Hang on. I'll tell you who he was.
I think it was George, wasn't it? Was he the Surveyor of India or something like that?
Yes, he was a British surveyor. He had been the Surveyor General of India, George Everest, when the British were drawing up maps and deciding which parts they owned and which parts they also owned. They named it after him.
Colonel Sir George, yeah.
Yeah.
You've got to give Wilson respect for his persistence. He kept being driven back by the weather. The first time he attempted to go without Sherpas, but the second time, these two chaps called Tewand and Rinzing insisted on going with him. And it was just a series of aborted attempts up Everest. Right, his penultimate diary entry on the 29th of May, 1934, was...
the fact you've said penultimate diary entry gives a little bit of a spoiler for where this is heading.
This will be a last effort, and I feel successful. And then his final one... Oh, yeah, the next day, he stayed in bed. His last diary entry on the 31st of May, 1934, simply said, "Off again. Gorgeous day." Which is just a lovely understatement, isn't it?
Oh, well, maybe... did he get to the final page of his diary? And that's what it was. Yeah. I mean, he was fine. He did everything he wanted to do, but he had no room to write it down. And it's all ends happily ever after. Yeah?
Yeah.
I mean, I'd love to tell you that that was true. But a year later, Eric Shipton, a British man, led a small reconnaissance expedition to Mount Everest and found his frozen body.
No.
So... that's the thing with going up to the peak of Everest, isn't it? You've just got like these ice lozenges full of people who weren't as good at mountaineering as you.
Yeah, it's very grim.
Yeah.
I can't remember what they call it. There's a bit of it where there's, you know, basically the bit where all the bodies are dumped, bits of equipment are. It's like a little sort of a rite of passage to walk along this bit.
I have a feeling, given that we're doing the worst explorers in the world, there's going to be a lot of death in this, isn't there?
Oh, there is.
Oh, yeah.
It's just different levels of people expiring in different parts of the world.
Yeah. I mean, I enjoy the plucky courage of the guy.
Yeah. Yeah. If you're listening to this podcast, listen to our individual contributions. But as you feel like we're going towards the end of this, maybe just skip on 5 minutes.
Yeah. The thing is, though, the fact that he was there writing his diary suggests that, and I mean, he went for the second attempt, meant he survived the crash landing of the plane.
Yeah, well, I think it was like a deliberate crash landing.
Yeah, so, but that's, I mean, that takes a, that's a level of achievement in itself.
Oh, absolutely.
They gave Sully a medal in America for landing on the Hudson. This guy landed on a mountain. Not just any mountain.
Yes, but he did it in the 1930s. And if the documentary movies Indiana Jones have proved anything to me, it's that physics didn't apply in the 1930s in the same way that it does in the modern day.
Very true. Yeah.
Is landing on a mountain more difficult than landing on a river? Because if we've learned anything from Greek explorers, is that water can have like the same sort of consistency as a jellyfish.
Yeah.
But I mean, it could congeal around Sully's plane. Anything yeah. could have happened to that.
Could have wrapped him in its immense tentacles. Yeah.
There is a specific sort of, I have tweed, will travel, yeah. explorer. That I really like in Britain at that time, I have to say.
Yeah,
and
I like
Anglo-Irish, same sort of thing as well.
I want to know like what he brought with him, because it's always like he brought an entire library and two hams.
Well, you
and things like
you
that.
Mentioned that, because my suggestion is not an Englishman or an Irishman, it's a Frenchman, and the what he brought with him as part of his essential staff, and
I know who this is. I know who this is.
Yeah.
This is Eric Cantona going from Leeds to Manchester United.
Yeah, he led an enormous parade all the way from Elland Road to Old Trafford. It was...
He had a trawler. There were seagulls following it. It was amazing.
But no, this is a French millionaire called Charles-Eugène Badeau. And he aimed to cross about 1,400 miles from the northern parts of Alberta through British Columbia in Canada whilst making a film as he did it. He was accompanied by more than 100 people, including his wife, an Academy Award-winning film director from Hollywood called Floyd Crosby, who would later go on to film High Noon, two limousines... Oh, wow. Five newly invented Citroën half trucks, 130 horses loaded with caviar and champagne, a film crew, scientific surveyors, a butler, a valet, several Alberta cowboys, a maid in waiting, and of course, his mistress, who was an Italian countess.
Well, he was French.
Yeah, exactly.
It was very restrained to only bring the one mistress.
I'd say he was filling in the to-do list and top of it was mistress. I mean, come on.
But sorry, I'm so confused because so what year was this?
This is 1934.
So the limousines, yeah, limousines and Citroën vans have existed, yet he's bringing 140 horses.
It's not, by the way, limousine cattle, by the way, is it?
Yeah, I presume, yeah.
Oh gosh, it might have been. That would make a lot more sense, wouldn't it? But the Citroën...
Stretch limousine cattle.
What?
Yeah, with the boomerang thing on the back of the cow.
Yeah.
Yeah, and each cow has 12 legs.
Yeah, they're bright pink.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, there's a hen party in the back of it with a little disco ball hanging off its horn.
I mean,
yeah, literal
you're
hens.
Not far off, because some of the ways he made his millions was by being a pimp back in Paris.
Are you kidding me?
He was an incredibly over-the-top, barely legal man. He did a training camp, like our friend Maurice Wilson. It involved hiking, rafting, and mountain climbing. Well, that was the aim, but they didn't actually do any training sessions because there were too many champagne parties and formal dinners being held in their honour before they went. It's not just, like, too much money and not enough sense, but it's that multiplied by worrying levels of charisma and a lack of sense of your own safety.
After 2 weeks of multiple champagne parties and asking everyone to quarantine, I surprised my closest inner circle with a trip across Canada where we could pretend things were normal just for a brief moment in time.
Everybody fell behind because I rode on with my 140 horses. I shouted them to keep up.
Yeah.
That is how my diary entries would be labelled from now on.
Well, it sort of reads, the tale of it is a bit like a reality TV show that's got out of hand, because he took all the Citroëns with, because he was mates with André Citroën, or Andy Citroën to English people, and he brought them with as like a promotional thing, but they weren't making enough of waves in the British, Canadian and French press. So he slid two of the five Citroëns off a cliff and then attempted to explode the third one with a stick of dynamite whilst he was on a raft, so he could then send pictures and footage back to all the newsrooms around the world to go, we're in perilous trouble.
Slash, they're making literal waves now.
Yes.
Because I'm blowing them up in rivers.
So...
That's so good.
I know.
Did he get... From where was he going from? And
he was going from Alberta to British Columbia, which is about 1,400 miles.
Did he make
it? No.
If he had, it would be amazing, because every other journey after that exploring would have to do it the way he did it.
Yeah. I mean, it says here they need champagnes and caviar. Well, I suppose he was successful.
They're trying to develop like a railway from Alberta to British Columbia, and I said, oh no, actually, this, you need five limousines. you need at least one mistress.
You don't change a winning team. We know this, right? So if he had made it, we'd all have to be doing this. Every time we all went to a gig, like, who's got the mistress? Got the mistress.
They ended when 4 months in, the horses started to die, and he basically went, should we call it a day, lads? Let's call it a day. And they reached a place called Hudson's Hope, which is like one of the furthest possible outposts there. And when they basically went, let's call it a day, and they threw an enormous champagne party in that town. And the citizens of that town were like, yeah, delighted to have you here.
He does sound like if Elton John met Christopher Columbus. And they had an explorer child. This is what it would be. Just champagne all over the place and caviar and like proper Rocket Man tiaras era Elton John.
Yeah, it really is. The most important thing when you meet Inuits for the first time is that you look fabulous.
Yeah.
Hi, I'm Abby and this is Alan.
Hello.
We're from the Lunatics Radio Hour podcast, where we explore the history of horror and modern horror storytelling.
We do deep dives into legends like ghost trains or the Headless Horseman or Wendigos.
Available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Including cell phones and computers.
I'm going to go for an Irishman, Robert O'Hara Burke, who's very well known in Australia, Burke and Wills. They were the first Europeans to go to traverse Australia. And Robert O'Hara Burke was a Protestant man from Galway. The reason I say he was Protestant is because it was quite unusual for him to have joined the Austrian Catholic Army. He was a policeman, and then he went to Australia. And the Royal Society in Melbourne said, we are going to try and get to the North Coast. We will have an expedition. So who will we hire? I know that man who has absolutely no experience as an explorer in any way, shape or form. Why don't we just use a policeman? So they used him. He regularly got lost. He could not navigate. He interviewed loads of people for this particular expedition, and then just discounted it and just picked people that he had some connection to, right? Yeah. So off they went in 1860 from Victoria. One of the main reasons he did it, by the way, is because he wanted to impress a girl. Always a brilliant reason. Yeah. Always a brilliant reason.
Whereas what have we learned from my guy? Take the girl with you.
You see, yeah, that's okay, right. So that's mark one against O'Hara Burke. Didn't bring the girl with him.
Can I also say as well, I like the fact they've gone, you know, exploring the north, when we talk about the planet is desperately cold. Exploring the north in Australia is going through a desert. And they've gone, we want a pasty man from Galway to walk through the red center of this continent.
Find me a man who, on contact with any sort of temperature above 25 degrees, freckles will explode off his face. Yes. A West of Ireland man. That's who I want. Yeah. That's a good point, because they didn't know what was in the centre of Australia. They had no idea. And at the start, actually, at the penal colonies, it suited their needs to possibly exaggerate the dangers internally, because you don't want the lads escaping.
Yeah.
So prisoners have been told, there's an inland sea, there's Etonians run the government. It's chaos in there. It's chaos. So he fired a man for being drunk before they set off on the particular day that they set off. The first wagon broke down 75 yards from where they set off. In They brought camels and horses. Camels hate horses, and horses hate camels. Like, they really don't get on in any way, shape, or form.
I didn't know that about camels and horses. This is like...
Oh, yeah, very much like the Crips and the Bloods. Apparently, yeah, they're just a very uneasy around each other, right?
Yeah.
They took with them between 19 and 20 tons of supplies, including a full dining table, dining chairs, and a bath for the desert, lads. For the desert.
I read that they also brought, for some reason, a Chinese gong.
Yeah, I mean, you have to have some sort of ceremony.
To summon people for dinner time, presumably.
Lads, I feel just this opium den that we've set up in the desert is really, really missing something. It's like a sense of, yeah, sense of occasion. How will we know when to stop? Gong. Oh. You've thought of everything, Robert O'Hara Burke. So Burke is the Irish guy. Wills is the English surveyor, and he's very good in terms of writing things down and surveying and basically keeping the scientific record of everything. Yeah,
he's a surgeon, so he's a bit of a scientific mind, at least.
He is, yeah, he's very good. The first 750 kilometers takes them 56 days. A horseman could have ridden that in those days in 10 days.
Wow.
But they're bringing all sorts of mad stuff with them, right? He eventually, this is quite complicated. So he stops in Cooper's Creek, which is kind of halfway up, right? And he splits his party. And he says, myself, a guy called King, Gray, and Wills, we're going to make a burst for the north coast, okay? And we're going to leave the other guys. Here's four or five other guys there. You stay here for 3 months, right? And he made a burst for the north coast. After losing, by the way, 19 tons, or starting off with 19 tons, they, at this point... when they got to Cooper's Creek, they had four men going up to the north coast with six camels and one horse, right? They had 3 months of provisions to walk 3,000 kilometers in a round trip. Yes. Right? So they had to do 30 kilometers a day over ground that they knew nothing about. So yeah, they said to their mates, you stay in Cooper's Creek. We're going to leave you with some food here. Wait for 3 months and then you can leave. It took them longer than that. It took them 4 months. Now, the lads stayed in Cooper's Creek, right? And they, when Burke and Wills got back to Cooper's Creek, they found a tree. It's called the Dig Tree. And on it was written, carved in, dig here. The other guys had left that morning.
They
missed them by a matter of hours. So they dug up their provisions. The people who they're going to be resupplied had left that day. So... then they bury the provisions again. Burke doesn't think to carve on the tree, we were here. We're knocking around the area, lads. If there's anybody looking for us, we're knocking around the area.
Yeah.
And then he doesn't go, do you know something? I'll keep going back down the way we went back to Melbourne. Because if there's a rescue party, it's coming up the way we went. Because we know one thing from chatting to Barry. Somewhere that you've been before.
Yeah.
Much easier to navigate again.
Oh, this isn't...
He tried to go home a different way. That didn't work. The only people feeding him at this point, by the way, were the local Aboriginal people who were feeding him Nando's. If he kept refusing the Nando's. He didn't like Peri Peri.
He was a KFC man. KFC man.
He, in those days, Ireland broke down into Protestants who liked KFC and the Colonel, and Catholics like Nando's. Yeah. People don't realize this. There's not enough written about this. Had rows with the Aboriginal tribes who were actually feeding there,
yeah,
and then expired in the desert. He died. Wills died. John King got back and survived.
Yeah. The thing about the tree is interesting because they left their provisions and they buried a note under, yeah, the tree saying, oh, we've passed through here. So a scout coming looking for them didn't find the note because it was buried. Whereas if they'd carved it in the tree saying, oh, we've been here, we went that way or something, someone might have found them and led them to some safety.
There were three of them left. So it was John King, Burke and Wills. They got back to Cooper's Creek. And Burke and Wills died a few days afterwards from starvation. Beside billabongs, teeming with fish. But they'd given away their fish hooks and stuff. They probably still had the Chinese gong. I don't know.
Yeah, I'm now having horrible images of them. They're like literally trying to catch fish with their bare hands.
Well, they tried to eat seeds, and they tried to pound it into this bread. But when the Aboriginals made it, they made it and they sluiced water through it, and it took all the and then cooked it and took out the chemicals. Whereas when the lads made it, didn't know how to do this, chemicals remained in there. I think it's thiamine or some kind of compound of that. And that actually affects your absorption of vitamin B. So it makes you get beriberi.
Oh, wow. Oh, so they thought, they were copying them, but not knowing the exact intricacies of it.
Yeah. And one guy who survived, John King.
The guy who works for CNN.
What happened was, he stood in front of Australia and he put it on a wall.
Yeah.
And he was able to highlight individual places that he had been.
Yeah.
And that's how he found his way back. Now, the people who had lived there for 50,000 years helped him. He took their help.
Yeah.
And then he survived, and then he was eventually rescued. It was a disaster from start to finish.
I love the thing about the 75 yards, the card getting, because 15,000 people were watching them leave on this expedition.
Yeah, they become massively famous. Yeah. And he didn't write down anything. So from Cooper's Creek all the way up to the Gulf of Carpentaria and back, Burke's diary is 850 words.
What?
Just emojis.
Yeah, just the sweating hot emoji. Just that one.
Sweating. Yeah.
People thought he was horny, but actually he wanted a drink and they weren't able to communicate with him. I like they got to the Gulf of Carpentaria, to say the coast, but there was a mangrove grove in the way, so they couldn't even see the shoreline to realize they'd done it.
So technically speaking, they saw kind of tidal water and it was salt. So they knew, okay, we're at the coast. But yeah, they didn't even get that glory. The glory of seeing the ocean in front.
I love one of the things they discarded along the way, because you're right, they did sort of realize, oh, we're carrying some of the wrong stuff. They dumped 1,500 pounds of sugar on the way.
Yeah, they had a public auction at one point. and they went, oh, we've got too much gear. Antiques Roadshow? Antiques Roadshow! And they went for this. He threatened his second in command to a duel at one point. He basically was, he was almost like, he was unbelievably charismatic. That's what comes across when you read these stories. And people will have followed him almost literally to the ends of the earth. But he had no experience and was consumed by showing off for his girlfriend. But of course, people love. So who got to the South Pole first?
Oh, gosh. Amundsen and his team.
Amundsen. Everybody remembers Scott.
Scott, yeah.
Because Scott was the noble failure. And Burke and Wills, everybody remembers it because it was, I mean, they got there, but I mean, it was a noble failure
as well.
It's
also when you describe this absolute madman being wheeled through the outback in a bath whilst challenging his second in command to a duel. And then I read the plot lines of some of Spike Milligan's goon shows and goes, these are documentary, Spike.
Yeah, the last of the summer wine getting some of their ideas.
Like, if you're bringing camels and horses, right, and you're going to do this, do you really need, for example, 12 sets of dandruff brushes and 4 enema kits? That is what they did. That's what they brought.
Well, to be fair, he does sound like he was full of shit.
Yeah.
So. I like, there's a couple other things I like in this, is that Wills's full name is William John Wills. So he's Will Wills. And one of the, it sounds like O'Hara Burke was like immensely charismatic, but also like could rub people up the wrong way really easily. On one occasion, 6 men quit just en masse because they had arguments very early on in the expedition.
In the middle of the public auction, by the way, in the middle of, you know, really, really hostile territory, they got rid of the lime juice as well. The one thing that's going to make sure that you don't get scurvy, they got rid of it. You just think, lads, at no point did anybody go, I don't know if we're doing this right.
Yeah.
I don't think we're doing this the right way at all.
Also, I like the idea of people quitting in the middle of the Great Australian Desert. Just like, fuck you, I'm going home. Somehow,
which direction do you storm away to? Like, you can't even slam a door of a tent, can you?
And it's quite hard to walk in a straight line as well without any like frames of reference. You tend to walk in a spiral, apparently. So eventually, that person would have circled back round to them again. I've gone, I forgot my handbag.
I forgot my dandruff brush and my enema kit. Mm.
the world's worst Ford car is the Ford Explorer, apparently. According to carcomplaints.com, the website has had 12,897 complaints about the Ford Explorer itself. And apparently the 2006 Explorer is the worst one of all because of high repair costs. And the 2002 Ford Explorer had the most total complaints submitted. And apparently the worst thing, the thing that kept coming up the most often, was a cracked panel below the rear window on the 2004 Explorer. Like stuff that going wrong in the inside of the car, like a wrong transmission or something. You can feel like that's an assembly line thing. But if there's like a panel on the outside of the car, which everyone's like, that's cracked, that one's cracked, that one's cracked. That's a major oversight.
That's all well and good, but how good is the Ford Explorer at going over Australian desert land?
I mean, they may have had a chance. It depends who's driving it. I suppose if it's Burke, maybe not much of a chance. Fair. The 2006 and 2002 Ford Explorer have a mark from the carcomplaints.com website, which is like a sticker, like a badge of honor saying, avoid like the plague.
It's like the Fiat quarantine. Very bad. The Renault bubonic. Oh my God.
I also looked up the, I just looked up the phrase Weird Explorer on Google just to see if something interesting would come up. And there's a website, weirdexplorer.com, run by a chap called Jared Rydelek, who is a New York-based contortionist and circus sideshow performer who was raised vegetarian. And he says himself, with a jaded palate, my obsession with fruit started when I was a kid. Anytime I saw a new fruit, I just had to try it. So he now does, he has a YouTube channel and this website where he basically travels the world trying to eat and review every edible fruit in existence. So he goes around the world, he like just trying really nice fruit and really horrible fruit. And yes, Ben, before you ask, he has tried the durian fruit.
Good.
Which is meant to smell terrible.
Like in fact, his flesh.
Yes, his review of it is actually that. It offends all five of the senses. it looks horrible. It's got these spikes and it sort of feels kind of horrible. The inside feels like congealed scrambled egg. It smells terrible. It sounds very squelchy. And then you taste it. And he said actually the first time he tried durian, it didn't taste so much. He had some in Malaysia where apparently they have the best durian and tried it again. In the video, when he's trying it, literally as they're cutting it open, the heavens open in a most apocalyptic rainstorm. As if to go, no!
I had that at the middle of the start of lockdown. My wife was talking to me, right? She's talking to me. So she's facing me and behind me is the kind of French doors thing, right? And she goes, how bad can this lockdown be? And at that moment, I swear to God, at that moment, two magpies chased a pigeon into the French windows. So she said, how bad can this be? And a pigeon committed suicide right over my shoulder. Bang, and then slowly slid down the glass. And we just went, and we just had to go to bed. Went to bed.
We're very glad you've gotten up specially for us today, a year later.
It's a year later.
I then read about a chap called Arthur David Whaley, who is described on his Wikipedia page as an English orientalist and sinologist. He was one of the early translators of Chinese and Japanese poetry into English in the early 20th century. He's very high achieving. He was a CBE. He won the Queen's Gold Medal for Poetry. He was invested as a Companion of Honor. He was involved in the Bloomsbury Group, you know, Virginia Woolf and all of those people. He worked in the British Museum. Very, very highly learned, but he tended not to go for sort of academic roles. He tried to write in a sort of a popular way. And he translated, you know, Chinese poetry and Japanese poetry, and then some novels, like the Tale of Genji. And Monkey from the 16th century China, and all these amazing things. And he's evaluated by a guy called E. Bruce Brooks. He said he's the great transmitter of the high literary cultures of China and Japan to the English reading general public, an ambassador from East to West in the first half of the 20th century. He was self-taught, but reached remarkable levels of fluency, even erudition in both languages. It was a unique achievement, possible only in that time and unlikely to be repeated. And by the way, guys, he never, ever visited Asia.
Amazing.
Oh, that's quality.
That is amazing. I'm going to devote my life's work to the like highest culture of these two very different societies. And this guy's gone, I'm going to dig deep, deep into the soul of those countries. But damned if I'm ever going to go visit them.
So what year did he die? Or what year did he...
He was born in 1889, died in 1966.
So like, he's not watching a lot of Japanese telly.
Yeah, exactly.
Do you know what I mean? Or Chinese telly. For the early part of his life, where is he going to use it?
That's the amazing thing. Like, he's, as he says, completely self-taught. He's not like in an academic institution. And then he's using this skill to disseminate it to in popular ways rather than, you know, highbrow and...
But presumably he's walking around where he lives just looking for random Chinese and Japanese people. Yeah. And they're slightly freaked out by this. And he's like, no, I just want to talk to you because I know all this stuff and I have no other outlet.
Yeah, so I thought that's quite a terrible explorer in the way that he has explored these societies, but not done the groundwork. He's done the theory, but not the practical, I think. I read the same sort of articles I read about Burke and Wills. I read about this chap, the Swedish guy called Salomon August André. He wanted to visit the Arctic. He wanted to be one of the first people to the North Pole. He was born in 1854, died in 1897. And he thought the way to do it was by hot air balloon.
In the Arctic?
Yes, correct.
Right.
And he had some pretty powerful patrons, the Swedish royal family, who were looking at Norway, and Amundsen was Norwegian, and was very jealous of their polar exploration and their exploration in general, and thought, this is it. Sweden is going to strike a blow. André was the guy that they invested all their time and money in. He gave a series of public lectures where he was laying out his calculations and explaining his credentials as a pilot, arguing how he would use the midnight sun to make observations as he progressed. He had his own hydrogen balloon called the Svea, which he tested on a number of short journeys just to see how good a pilot he was. And the answer was not very good, guys. He had terrible powers of observation. He once mistook the Baltic Sea and a lighthouse for land and a lake.
Oh, that's a big one, isn't it?
I mean, yeah, sea and lighthouse equals land and lake. And I hope it's in that order, because then he's confused the land bit.
Yeah, I mean, that's the bare minimum that is required there.
He tried to basically let the wind blow him the right direction. And he learned on his first attempt that frost and drag ropes to try and steer the balloon, the frost can make the ropes heavier and drag the airship down. So he had another go in 1897. The wind was blowing north, and his second balloon called Eagle was released. And once they got up there and got going, the conditions were absolutely terrible. And in like cartoon hot air balloon fashion, the crew were just chucking stuff overboard to try and keep themselves up. This article says after several crashes, it was finally rendered useless 3 days later.
There must be a very awkward moment when it's evident what's happening and everybody at the same time turns to the heaviest member of crew.
Oh, yeah. Well, the best bit is at this point, because the whole point of the thing is we're going to map the Arctic from the air. Now, stuck on the ground, they go, well, let's continue on foot. But they've, in jettisoning loads of supplies to try and keep themselves afloat, they have thrown away much of their food supply. So they're now shooting and trying to eat bears. They eventually camp down back at the crash site and spend 3 weeks there, and they pack up and set out to go again. But they broke their sleds with the equipment they did have on to try and make every attempt. Whatever they're bringing is far too heavy because it breaks the balloon, it breaks the sleds. On the 4th of August, they tried to turn back round, but the wind was too hard and they built a shelter on an ice floe. It broke up in taking them out to sea and they disappeared. But it's also at the time where there's loads of aviation pioneers and people who presumably can fly hot air balloons. And they've got this guy's going, well, I have a damn good crack at it.
Yeah, that, funny enough, you could probably slide some of the way on a Chinese gong.
Yeah.
Like if they had just got the wrong packing, that's all.
That was a mistake. That was their mistake.
Burke and Wills got the wrong Amazon package. And the other guys, it's a disaster. And they ended up on an ice floe.
Yeah, they thought it would bring them out to sea and maybe then they'd run into a ship was kind of their thinking, but the ice floe got smaller and smaller and smaller.
They seem to have a fundamental lack of basic knowledge about how the temperature and ice and sun work.
But they've also gone, the wind will take us to the Arctic. All right, the tides will take us to safety. They're very much not under their own steam at all.
Frozen things get heavy. They didn't realize that.
Yeah, yeah.
You don't stare into the midnight sun. They didn't realize that. You don't try and shoot bears. The only thing up there that would kill you. They don't realize that. And this ice floe, that's going to be remain frozen and get us home. It's fine.
Yeah.
just imagining a pair of polar bears watching this crumpled hot air balloon slowly float past on an ice floe.
That's Deliveroo to a polar bear, isn't it?
That's the hot package, you know, the silvered box they keep it in to keep it warm. That's the hot air balloon.
Yeah.
But I've got to talk about something. I mentioned this when we did our Around the World in 80 Fails podcast episode recently, Ben. The Explorers Club.
Mm-hmm.
In 1904, a group of men in New York set up the Explorers Club, which is meant to unite explorers in the bonds of fellowship and promote exploration by whatever means possible. They included the journalist and explorer Henry Collins Walsh, Adolphus Greely, Donaldson Smith, Carl Lumholtz. I think we've talked about Greely on the podcast before. Marshall Saville, Frederick Delambre, and David Brainard. And yeah, they admit individuals who contribute to the cause of exploration and sustained interest in scientific exploration, scientific knowledge, and so on. They point out on the website, extensive travel without a scientific purpose or objective, big game hunting, photography, or similar pursuits in remote parts of the world do not represent sufficient qualifications to become a member of the Explorers Club. So having a travel Instagram account is not enough for them.
Yeah, yeah. There's an asterisk there. You know who you are, gap year students.
Yeah, yes. The current president is a chap called Richard Garriott. He's been on expeditions across all seven continents and to both poles and into outer space as a private astronaut. He was the sixth private astronaut to live on board the International Space Station. They like to boast on their website about their five famous firsts. Members of the Explorers Club include Peary and Henson, who were the first, recognized as the first people to go to the North Pole, although in retrospect, they probably weren't. Amundsen, who was the first to the South Pole, was there. Hillary and Tenzing Norgay were both admitted. Don Walsh and Jacques Piccard, who were the first to the deepest point of the ocean. And Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin are also members.
But not Michael Collins. That's a bit of a sick boom.
Not Michael Collins. It's so sad, isn't it?
Ah, that is rough.
Yeah.
Good film, though.
Very good film. Yeah. Oh, sorry. This is the other thing I want to mention. In 1925, the Society of Women Geographers was founded by people like Marguerite Harrison, Blair Niles, Gertrude Shelby, and Gertrude Emerson. They had covered hundreds of thousands of miles exploring various places themselves, but they weren't admitted to the Explorers Club because they were women. The first women weren't admitted to the Explorers Club until 1981. So these people took it upon themselves to found their own society. Yeah, they hosted a dinner in 1932 at the Museum of Natural History in New York. And newspapers reported on people who attended it, like Amelia Earhart and a woman called Elizabeth Dickey, who brought with her the mummified head of a South American Indian, presumably as a date. And members of that society include Rachel Carson, who we've talked about on the podcast, famous environmentalist, Margaret Mead, Jane Goodall, and the likes. But wow. The thing that stood out for me when I read about the Explorers Club is they have an Explorers Club flag. There are 200, they're numbered as well. So they're limited edition things. There are 202 of them. Each of them have their own history. So different numbered flags have been taken on different expeditions in history. And some of them have been retired and have been framed in the museum. So there was a miniature flag that the astronauts on board Apollo 11 had. So that one's there. Thor Heyerdahl, who was on Kon-Tiki, his flag is there. Bob Bartlett, he rescued the members of the Crocker Land Expedition, which we've talked about in the podcast. His flag is there. And Roy Chapman Andrews, who brought the first fossil dinosaur eggs to the American Natural History Museum. All of their flags are in this club. You read a bit further about people who have these flags, and one of them is among the honorary members of the club. Honorary members include Theodore Roosevelt, John Glenn, Jim Fowler, Walter Cronkite, Prince Philip, the Duke of Edinburgh, Edmund Hillary, I mentioned, Buzz Aldrin, and Albert, Prince of Monaco, and L. Ron Hubbard.
Uh-oh.
My suggestion for the world's worst explorer is going to be the man who gave us Dianetics and Scientology.
What does he claim to have discovered or explored?
Thetan level 5, lads. Thetan level 5.
Well, the Explorers Club says that he has two Explorers Club flags. His Scientology biography suggests he has three. It's like reading the biography of Kim Jong-il and then reading like a Wikipedia or a Western article about Kim Jong-il. They're very disparate in how they present the man. He went on an expedition in Flag 105, L. Ron Hubbard took on the Alaska Radio Experimental Expedition. He joined the Explorers Club in 1940 because he said he had explored the Caribbean. Now, what he had actually done is that when he was in university, he took a semester off to go to the Caribbean.
Yes, I've explored the Caribbean on my honeymoon. I don't think I get a little flag for it.
He said he was there to explore and film the pirate stronghold and bivouacs of the Spanish Main, and I quote, to collect whatever one collects for exhibits in museums.
I've explored Birmingham Glee Club.
So yeah, he went on this Alaskan radio experimental expedition. It was basically him and his wife on board his sailboat, which was called Magician. And they said they were going to experiment with new forms of radio navigation. The ship basically kept breaking down and he had to write stories and sell them to local radio stations to earn the money to fix the engine to make it back again.
Oh, God, can you imagine that your car breaking down? You're like, I'm just going to have to send really good tweets until the AA come and pick me up.
Yeah.
They would find my skeleton beside the car. Beside the Citroen that I bought from your man that was on fire.
He had a go at trying to join the US Navy. A commandant in the Boston Navy Yards in 1942 said he was not temperamentally fitted for independent command. And was relieved of his command of a Navy patrol boat, which might explain later in life why he founded what he called the Sea Organization and made himself the Commodore on board his own personal fleet, which was basically a quasi-paramilitary membership group of the Scientologists.
Okay, you can only be a self-appointed Commodore if you are 6 years old in your own bathtub.
Children, unfortunately, feature in this, because from about 1970, he was attended on board ship by the children of many Sea Organization members, young girls, mainly dressed in hot pants and halter tops, who were responsible for running errands for him, like lighting his cigarettes, helping him get dressed, or delivering messages around the ship. Other things he did in later life, by the way, they then decided they needed to have like a land base. They tried to take over the town of Clearwater, Florida, in an operation they called Operation Normandy. And the Scientologists now own about 60 buildings in the town. And they were also involved in an Operation Snow White, or the Snow White program, where they spied on the United States government to try and delete negative reports and intelligence about Scientology. But the main reason I think he's a terrible explorer, all of that is that he's a terrible human being, and both Ben and I may be dead within weeks of this going out.
Can I just say, I think he's fantastic, if they're listening.
But in 1961, he got his second Explorers Club flag number 163, for the Oceanographic Archaeological Expedition. And yes, guys, that was a trip to investigate underwater sites of historical interest, such as submerged cities in the Mediterranean. He went looking,
Atlantis.
Basically, for Atlantis. Yes.
Wow.
Yeah.
that's just a wow on a lot of levels. I suppose so. You have to try and figure out, is somebody a terrible explorer who is a terrible explorer, or is someone who hasn't done any exploring a terrible explorer?
That is very much the conundrum I'm faced with.
Mm. By the way, the answer to this, the worst explorer, full stop, is internet.
Our candidates this week for the world's worst explorer are Ben's suggestion of Charles Bedeau, the French playboy who led a conga line of parties across Canada. Neil's suggestion of Robert O'Hara Burke, the brave Galwayman who just about made it to the north coast of Australia and back again, alienating pretty much everybody he met along the way. And my suggestion of L. Ron Hubbard, who didn't die, but whose body became too much of an inhibition for him, according to Scientology.
I love the fact that he thought, my religion hasn't got quite enough bullshit in it. It needs just a sprinkling of Atlantis to really...
Yeah. Ooh, I think you're right. L. Ron Hubbard is a terrible human being. But the Explorers Club deemed him worthy of entry. And he's up there with a lot of illustrious people. I don't know whether their membership criteria were as strict then as they are now, but they seem like pretty good arbiters of what makes a decent explorer.
Well, I've been allowed into Spearmint Rhino. I am not a rhino.
Yeah.
So I think just because you can get into the club, as Groucho Marx, I'm paraphrasing.
Yeah, doesn't mean that you belong there, I guess.
Yeah.
But yeah, I don't think he's the world's worst explorer. He's the world's worst lots of things, but probably not the world's worst explorer. So I'm going to discount my own, which leaves me with Bedeau and Burke. And there's sort of a fundamental difference between the two of them. They obviously have both prepared in similar ways, but Bedeau seems like he's going for the party lifestyle, whereas Burke has an earnestness about him that I quite enjoy. Bedeau has gone with like the Hollywood films and his wife and his mistress and the limousines and all the champagne. So he knows he's going to have a wild and crazy time. Burke is an Irishman who has gone to the job interview going, yeah, of course I could do that. And been handed loads of money and loads of responsibility and failed nobly, but also succeeded. He got there, but he just didn't manage to get all the way back. So I think just I think he just edges it for me in terms of the... I think he really wanted to succeed and didn't, whereas Badeau didn't quite... I don't think he cared whether he succeeded or not. So I'm going to give the victory to Neil. Congratulations.
I can't believe how much I wanted this as we went something awakened in me going, if I don't win this, I'm going to win. I read a whole book about this.
Yeah. Before we go, we've got to give you some of the world's best news of the week. We are continuing to give you good news while the pandemic continues. And what? There's only one news story on everyone's lips the Monday we're recording this. And that is the magnificent news that the Ever Given has been freed from the Suez Canal. Given we did a podcast where we went around the world in 80 days tracing Phileas Fogg's journey, and that he did go through the Suez Canal, and we talked lots about Suez a month ago. The fact that a ship got blocked in it doing that bit from Friends or that bit from Austin Powers a month late is infuriating for Ben and I. But we I just love the fact that it seems like everyone's been glued to this like global naval navigation tracker website going, no, it's still at 45 degrees. It hasn't been turned yet.
I couldn't look at the satellite footage of it because I've got quite high cholesterol.
And also, as we've learned earlier, you cannot picture turning shapes around in your head. So
No. I would have had to just leave us, lads. I know a core or 12% of the world's freight goes through here, but it's over.
Yeah. Apparently at least 367 vessels carrying everything from crude oil to cattle had been blocked in the Suez Canal waiting to get through.
Do you know what I liked as well? The reports meant, oh, the other ships are in a holding pattern. You're going No, that's for the sky because you can't hover. A ship in a holding pattern is just afloat.
It's just apparently there were. I love this. There were cheers at the sight of it on Monday morning when the stern of the ship was successfully rotated about 8 degrees.
I sort of feel like the way that they got it out of there was the canal equivalent of a burly midwife. We're just there with the Suez Canal. Do your breathing exercises, Canal. Come on, you can do it. Just that and like tons and tons of goose fat.
Did anyone come up and give it a stern pat on the back?
I have fully changed my mind. Can I have Burly Midwife as my wrestling name? She's gone to the top rope with the forceps. This is going to be good.
Oh, man. So before we go, Neil, where can people find out more about you and the podcast you're doing and hear about your gigs and all of that?
Can I recommend, by the way, The Dig Tree, a book, if you want to read more about Robert O'Hara Burke and Wills. It's a great book. They can look at my Instagram at Neil Delamere Comedy and Twitter at Neil Delamere. And I'm doing my first ever arena gig next year, SSE Arena in Belfast, which is currently a vaccination centre. So fingers crossed this whole thing will be over by then, next February. So if people want to go to that, that's the big gig I'm pushing at the moment.
Amazing. Well, we're all off to gather 20 flamingos, 100 bottles of porter and 18 zebras. That's the car brand. And try and make the trip from London to Birmingham. You ready, Ben? On your marks, get set, go. Thanks for listening, guys. Bye-bye.